Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray. In just a moment, we will be talking through all the big security news of the last 4 weeks or so with our good friend, Stanford University's Alex Stamos, who is filling in for Adam Boileau this week. And then we'll be chatting with Casey Ellis of BugCrowd in this week's sponsor interview. We will be hearing from Casey on the US federal government's decision to force all departments into accepting bug reports. He thinks this is a move that will have a big impact on the wider bug bounty ecosystem and vulnerability reporting ecosystem. We'll get to that in a bit. But before we start the show in earnest, I do feel like I need to say something here. I've been flooded with messages over the last few weeks from friends and listeners who are asking if my family and I are safe. And the answer is yes. The fire crisis actually started in my part of the country back in September last year. And the danger here more or less peaked around November. And yeah, we did have some extremely nervous days when things were looking pretty threatening. I mean, we copped it early up here. And the thing is, the fires weren't really on the media radar at the time, barely even domestically, let alone internationally. But since they've moved south and flared up even more, and it is an absolute disaster. I will be talking a little bit more about this after the week's news, so stick around for that if you want to hear me talk about that. But look, thanks again to everyone who reached out with messages of support and you know, just asking me if I was okay. It's, you know, it's nice to know that people are thinking of you at a time like this. As I say, I'll talk about that a little bit more later on, but let's get into the news now with Alex Stamos. And Alex, yeah, a few things have happened in the last few weeks, as they usually do when I go on holiday. And probably number one on the list, a big topic of discussion over the last week or so has been, you know, this escalation in risk from potential risk from Iranian hackers. What are you making of this? I mean, the thinking seems to be that because the United States has killed a Iranian general, that there's going to be this massive surge in Iranian activity. I'm not sure I quite buy that, to be honest, because they've been giving it a pretty solid nudge already. So my tip is probably a bit of an escalation and more destructive attacks. But what do you think?
What we might see is a shift towards destructive from intelligence gathering. You know, as a lot of people have been talking about, a lot of the good cyber units in Iran are part of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the specific group whose general was assassinated. And so they are definitely going to be motivated. As you said, the Iranians have been very active over the last several of years. And what, you know, you don't see them with Eternal Blue quality exploits and the like, but you do see them building solid tool chains, and then especially making up for whatever technical defects they have versus some of their bigger competitors, with a really good understanding of social issues and of how companies work. And so, like, their social engineering attacks and stuff have been very effective. What we haven't seen from them in the United States is the equivalent of a Shamoon or another wiper attack that's specifically meant to hurt American industry, like they have released multiple times in Saudi Arabia. So that might be what we see next, is something that might look like ransomware, but instead of being an intentional ransomware, something like a NotPetya that is there just to cause damage.
Yeah, DHS through CISA issued some guidance today or overnight. And number one on the list was offline backups, right? And I'm not so surprised by that, because I think the idea that we could start seeing some wiper attacks is pretty solid, right? But we've also seen some arguments cutting the other way from John Hillquist from FireEye wrote an interesting thread saying, you know, he's expecting to see an uptick in some espionage stuff as well, you know, tracking people's movements, things like that, tying that to possible, you know, real-world attacks against people, given the nature of the United States' strike against Soleimani. You know, what do you think of that? I mean, could we see, you know, Iranian intelligence trying to collect some more meat space info that they could use for actual, you know, violent operations?
You know, if the Iranians were looking for a real eye for an eye kind of response here, which I think would be very dangerous for them and for the world, but a possibility, then attacking an American general or a you know, employee of the State Department, a diplomat, maybe another a prominent executive would be possibly on their list. And certainly for a lot of Westerners, the best way to figure that out is if you don't have the kind of massive signals intelligence and you know, drone infrastructure the United States has, is to use open source intel or to use attacks against people's personal infrastructure. So I think he's right. If that is Iran's choice and they're looking to pinpoint Americans who are traveling throughout the Middle East for attack by the Iranians directly or by one of their proxy groups like Hezbollah, then we could definitely see some kind of cyber component in that targeting.
Yeah. Do you think, though, that some of the commentary on this has been a little overwrought?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, there was that one defacement of a government website, of a, yeah, a government agency that nobody in the United States – I mean, I'm surprised it even – continues to exist, that like somebody has paid the bill.
Well, it's funny, it's the Federal Deposit Library Program. And when news, they got defaced. And when news of this spread, I think my comment on Twitter was, oh no, not the FDLP. You know, yes. No.
I mean, I do like that you can call it like the Federal DLP. I think there's a cute little, acronym overload there. Yeah, the fact that the kind of mass media is really poised to position anything that happens out of Iran as Iran's counterattack, and clearly whatever the Iranians are officially going to do or the IRGC will do on their own is going to be something that's going to be more spectacular and planned. This is clearly just script kiddie. So I do think there's been overbearing here. I mean, I think we also just got to remember is Iran has significant capabilities to cause death and destruction throughout the Middle East through these proxy groups that Soleimani and others have helped support over the decades. And so, you know, this is a cyber podcast and that's what we're talking about, but I think there's a lot of risk that has no interesting technical component that the Iranians could put Americans and our allies in. Which I think will be really dangerous. We're not exactly talking about an American administration that would react thoughtfully to any such provocation.
Still, I think 2020, you know, whether or not this has anything to do with Iran, I mean, we're going to talk about all of the ransomware stuff that's happened over the last few weeks in just a moment. But I think the advice from DHS, offline backups, I think 2020 is going to be the year of offline backups, right?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, if you could buy stock in these companies, which you generally can't, it would probably be a good year. This is the year to have offline backups in the cloud, preferably of all your systems, and to test them. I mean, as somebody who has worked in production IT, only a fraction of the times that you test backups, do they work effectively and cleanly? And so testing your backups and your recovery strategies is a critical thing.
Yeah, recovering from backups is usually a project rather than a button push, right?
Right. Yeah. And in some of these cases, we're hearing about people having disasters after ransomware. They've either paid for the ransom, they've either paid the ransom or they've restored from backups and still they've stayed down because just the disruption has been something they have been able to get back from.
Now, look, we're going to move on to another story here. The New York Times wrote a story about this chat app from the UAE called Totok, which the NY Times alleges is essentially being published by an organization very close to the government. The thinking is that this is essentially an intelligence tool, a la WeChat in China, you know, very government-friendly tool. Since the New York Times published its story making these allegations, the app was removed from Apple's App Store and also the Google Play Store. It's since been reinstated by the Google Play Store. But the fact is, I mean, when we're talking about all stories like this, like it barely even matters if the central allegations in the original reporting are true. The fact is that this is a UAE-published chat app in the UAE, right? Like, that doesn't use end-to-end encryption, and even if it did, you'd be mad to trust it. I mean, that's kind right. of how I land on these things. What about you?
Well, it's reasonable for consumers to fall for this, right? If you're living in the UAE, you're living within a very limited internet environment. There's lots of apps that don't work, and so the fact that all of a sudden you got this chat app that does everything for free for you, that gives you access to all this data, should be suspicious. But I can see why people fell for it. Interestingly enough, according to the Times, TikTok was also being one of the most downloaded social apps in the United States. And so that's the other thing that's interesting here is that maybe you release something within one of these countries specifically to target the citizens, but the natural virality of a social app means that you will end up with a global install base, which makes it of interest to every country.
But I think in this case, I mean, that's mostly because of the diaspora. It's the same as WeChat in Australia. It's mostly, yes, you know, people of Chinese background who use it here. And right, politicians who want those people to vote for them.
Right. There are millions and millions of WeChat installs in the United States, and it is mostly people who speak Chinese, either citizens or immigrants. But so I think the Times reporting was actually pretty effective of tying together the parent company of TikTok to Dark Matter, which obviously has lots of links to the UAE government, up to being in the same building as the Signals Intelligence Branch. But the interesting thing here is, what TikTok technically is doing is they just built a messenger app with no end-to-end encryption. And if you build a messenger app and you put in all of the privacy requests into your app manifest, replicating what major American companies like a Google and Facebook and Twitter do, then you will make a spy app by default if all of a sudden you're giving all that data without limit to the government. And that's so,
I mean, it's indistinguishable, isn't it? Like the average chat app is indistinguishable from one that a spy agency would pump out because they all seek too many permissions and they get all your stuff.
Right. Having always on permission, always on contract grabbing, these are all things that big American companies have run into privacy issues with, which they've generally, you know, then narrowed their privacy requests. But it's not unreasonable for TikTok to say, you know, we're only doing what these other big companies are doing. The difference is on the back end, if this company only exists for gathering intelligence, and that means that there's no kind of lawful process on the back end, then that does make it a really important tool. I will point out, my expectation is WeChat provides the exact same service to the People's Republic of China that TikTok provides to the UAE, right? And so while it's great that there's some focus on TikTok, I think this needs to open up a much broader discussion about non-encrypted messenger products and which countries we trust those coming from.
But I mean, this is something we've touched on so many times in the show, is it's the WeChat approach. Block anything that you can't surveil. And then, you know, get one of your buddies, like your cousin or whatever, your brother-in-law, sister-in-law, to start a company that will cooperate with law enforcement. And then you just give unfettered access to everyone. Hey, look, reliable messaging. Guess what everybody's going to use? I mean, that is the China playbook. And it's been spectacularly successful. Why not emulate it if you're the UAE, right?
Yes. And it turns out, you know, most of this was code that was ripped off from some other products. It is really cheap to build a WeChat competitor that's not that great, but good enough if, as you pointed out, it is the only option because everything else is broken.
Yeah. And, you know, we don't know. It's not 100% confirmed. They haven't come out and said, ah, you got us. You know, we are a front for intelligence gathering. Funnily enough, though, I did get an email from a digital marketing agency representing TikTok. And they were like, yeah, we'd love to sponsor a podcast to talk about this. And I was just like, yeah, no. And it turns out Kim Zetter received a similar solicitation as, you know, an influencer. So they've been going out trying to like give, you know, cybersecurity reporters money to presumably say nice things about them, which I think is probably a strategy that's guaranteed to backfire on you every time. After that tweet, I tweeted about it saying, lol, basically, and I got a slightly salty email from the agency saying, thanks for your tweet about that. What do you guys expect? Come on. What do you expect?
I'm actually disappointed, Patrick. You should have taken them up on the deal and gotten paid in Bitcoin up front. And then we could have done 90 minutes that they sponsored on talking about how TikTok is just like WeChat. And both of them are incredible risks to individuals in those countries.
But this is the thing. It doesn't matter whether or not they're a willing front, right? The fact is you just would be mad to trust an app like this. You got to stick. Unless you have no choice, right? And I think that's the whole point of this conversation. From TikTok to TikTok, we got a story here from Cyberscoop. The headline says US Army bans TikTok amid ongoing scrutiny of Chinese-made video app. But like, it's a little bit more complicated than TikTok being just a Chinese app, isn't it?
That's right. So TikTok is a multinational company from its beginning. So they have engineers in the Bay Area and product managers. They have people in China. They are owned by ByteDance, which is a Chinese company. And so clearly the PRC has a lot of leverage over it, but they they say that their policy and their product management is independent, and that the data they store is stored in Northern Virginia and Singapore. Now, the actual location of data, as you and I know, is not as important as who has access to the data and what leverage do countries have over the people. And so I think it is completely reasonable for the U.S. government to be concerned about TikTok. But this is the kind of thing that is, this is the kind of ambiguity we're going to have to get used to.
Yes.
Because we're going to see more and more competitive Chinese products that are popular with Westerners, not just with the Chinese-speaking diaspora. And the kind of gray space within which Chinese companies all operate, where their relationship with the government is poorly understood, is the kind of thing we're all going to have to get used to figuring out how we're going to draw lines. Because we're not going to be able, as a free country, to just say no Chinese social apps can ever be installed by anybody in the United States. That's
well, and then even calling this a Chinese social app gets complicated, right? So, I mean, when yes. you're going to wind up with these obfuscated corporate structures where there's probably some Chinese control, but you're not really sure, where does X start and Y begin? You know, it all gets very complicated. But we have seen instances of TikTok removing videos that people were publishing that were talking about the plight of Uyghur Muslims, right? So, you know.
Yes.
There is a bit of a smoking gun there, but yeah, it's just something
right.
to keep.
I mean, there's some good empirical evidence that TikTok is doing censorship on behalf of PRC interests, even in the United States. There is a Twitter account called Air Moving Device, which is a individual who does research into some claims by the Chinese government, and he had a good series of tweets where he analyzed the latency of videos on certain topics being posted and available on TikTok. And he found if you do things like talk about Tiananmen Square or you mention Winnie the Pooh and the like, that there might be a significantly longer period of time during which apparently there's, you know, likely human review before those videos get posted. And that was true posting from the United States as well. That has been changed and fixed by TikTok, which doesn't mean they're not doing it anymore. It just means they probably got rid of the latency. But yes, it is a really interesting open question. And this whole issue is actually a great parallel to what we went through between the United States and Europe several years ago, when post Snowden disclosures, a number of privacy advocates made the argument that storing Europeans' data in the United States was inherently unsafe. That all got fixed by effectively an agreement between the European Union and the United States about what kinds of law enforcement requests will be made about European citizens, and the fact that the United States promised to not make those requests for certain purposes, like intelligence purposes. But it's the exact same kind of thing here, where all of a sudden, you know, the US, we were fine with the existence of the cloud, and now that Americans' data is sitting in a Singaporean AWS instance that's controlled from Beijing, we're getting a lot more nervous.
Now, staying with China, two giant tech firms in China have formed a joint venture to develop this, you know, Chinese native OS. And it's this story by Catalin Campana is a funny read, actually, because he goes through these companies' track records of developing OSs, and it's a little bit on the funny side, really.
Yeah, and they're really coming up with distributions of popular operating systems, right? So like the history here was there was a old homegrown OS called Kylin, which turned out really just to be a port of FreeBSD, which is fine. Like a lot of people have taken FreeBSD and turned it into products, including Apple, right? A big chunk of the user mode of OS X and iOS still has, it says copyright Regents of the University of California in there if you grep through the binaries. And so that's a totally reasonable thing to do. It's just, it is a little, and I don't think it's crazy for the Chinese to want to have their own Linux and FreeBSD distributions. It's just funny to call these like completely domestic operating systems. Nobody has a completely domestic operating system. Nobody in the world, including the United States. Windows has code contributed to it from people all over the world. Linux is obviously something that is developed all over the world. And I think that kind of weird, it has to be written by our citizens to be trustworthy, is just not how software is built, nor realistically how you need to look at the threat models here.
I think the thing that I found funny about this write-up is like how small the modifications to FreeBSD were. They really didn't, they barely touched it. And it's like, yay, job done. I wonder how much they got paid for that.
Right, because the idea that FreeBSD, which is run still by a bunch of long-haired hippies with gray ponytails and extremely libertarian tendencies, that FreeBSD is some kind of front for the U.S. government is just laughable for anybody who's ever met somebody who has a commit bit for BSD.
Now, moving to the Wall Street Journal, The Wall Street Journal has written this story basically saying that, Facebook did a really bad thing by notifying people who had been owned by Pegasus malware. You know, we spoke about this last year about how, essentially WhatsApp sent a notification to people saying, just so you know, you got NSO'd. Before doing this, WhatsApp did check for law enforcement requests to make sure that they weren't about to, drop a notification onto terrible people. This story says that European police of unspecified origin, I believe, were tracking a terrorist who was in the midst of planning an attack, and that terrorist went dark because of the WhatsApp message. A lot of people have attacked this piece for being sort of NSO group friendly propaganda. What's your take as someone who used to, work for Facebook?
Yeah, somebody who used to work for Facebook and I was specifically involved with some of the anti-NSO stuff before I left of trying to harden the product and come up with some legal responses. It's disappointing. The Wall Street Journal has some of the best cyber reporters, at least one of whom I really respect is representing this byline.
Yeah, Bob McMillan is there, right? And he's, he knows his stuff.
And I love Bob and I think he's great. Look, I don't have any kind of real factual arguments. I think the overall tone of the article is Facebook did a bad thing by warning these bad guys. It is playing into the NSO group's coordinated PR push, which has included them countersuing Facebook in Israeli court, which is obviously they're going to try to get a better hearing there, complaining about the fact that NSO employees and their family members have been banned from Facebook's products. Whine, complain. And then trying to make this case that their products have only been used by good guys going after bad guys for what most Americans might consider a reasonable definition of good and bad guy. We clearly know that is not true, right? We clearly know that Citizen Lab has specifically identified over 100 people who you cannot really justify being targets of NSO group. Now, that was of 1,400. That doesn't mean 1,300 of those people are bad guys. It just means their phone numbers were not that Citizen Lab in their research could not figure out who those people are or were not known to them. In this case, I think it is, what you're seeing is NSO working with some of their friends in law enforcement to try to start to build a groundswell of support against Facebook.
Totally. And when I look at a story like this, it's pretty clear what's happened is NSO has gone out to some of its customers and said, are you happy to talk to the press? Right. And they've made the introduction here. If I had to guess, that's how this happened.
Yes. They clearly went to a European group. This is a secret group in law enforcement that, as you said, did not tell Facebook that they needed a wiretap, right? And so Facebook did not have anywhere in their law enforcement databases that these were accounts that should not be notified. And here is a really important line in this article, right? So this is supposed to be in Europe, a land of laws, a land where people talk a lot about their care for privacy. When evidence gathered by his unit is used in court, efforts are made to hide the true source of the evidence. So this is a extra legal intelligence group that is creating parallel construction where they are using hacking tools to get information outside of legal oversight by European courts. So the scandal here is that this group exists and is able to operate in Europe, right? Like it just shows kind of some of the hypocrisy that we've heard from our European friends around privacy issues and that this has not become a much bigger deal. And so big picture, if you're an advocate, even if you're mad at Facebook, you're going to have to decide, do you want privacy or do you want people to have unfettered access to plain text for safety purposes, right? Like you can't just blame these big companies on both sides, which is what the Wall Street Journal is trying to do here. I think it is completely reasonable to give individuals the ability to communicate privately. I think that is the only future in which we have a reasonable amount of democracy and personal choice in a future where governments and public companies can't get access to all of our communications all the time. That doesn't mean that there isn't downsides to that. That doesn't mean there's not things the companies can't do better. But to make the case that NSO is just for the use of positive purposes is just clearly false. It's really unfortunate to see the Wall Street Journal carry their water on this. Like if you're a law enforcement agency, if you buy a product from a company that also sells their product to the Saudis to kill American green card holder journalists, then there is going to be the possibility of of some kind of OPSEC risk, right?
Yeah.
That needs to be part of the decision you make is when, you know, this European secret group, even if they're operating legally within their country, when they buy these products, they need to make very well sure that these products are not also being used by authoritarian states to go after activists and journalists.
I think we're going to see some movement. You know, it's interesting you just brought in the wider conversation about privacy, law enforcement, intelligence, all of that. And I think we are going to actually see some movements in the United States, some movement in the United States this year on that. You know, politicians like Lindsey Graham are having a good old grumble about the going dark issue. So, you know, it's the topic that refuses to die. Let's see what happens there. Now, look, we're going to turn, there are too many stories in this section to discuss individually, but I finished last year's season with a discussion about ransomware and about how in 2020, you know, we're going to see it used more and more just as a monetization mechanism for, you know, full compromise of corporate networks. And wow, you know, even in the last 3 weeks, it sort of seems like it sure is accelerating. We saw an alert from the United States government talking about a, you know, it was the U.S. Coast Guard issued a bulletin about a RIOC ransomware infection at a sort of federally regulated maritime facility. That was a pretty big deal. The city of Frankfurt had to shut down its IT network in response to a ransomware infection. TravelX, the currency exchanges, they've been having a really hard time battling a ransomware infection. We had a company in the United States, an Arkansas-based telemarketing firm. They have closed and left 300 people without jobs just before the holidays because they got ransomware and couldn't recover. We've seen, the city of Pensacola have a cyber event. The FBI is issuing bulletins about the Maze ransomware. We've seen the Zeppelin ransomware is now stealing data before encrypting it. New Orleans got hit by ransomware. And we've got a couple of stories from Krebs here. One is a IT services provider called Synoptec got ransomwared. What else have we got? And there's a great case study written up by Krebs here about how ransomware gangs are sort of outing victims that don't pay up, so sort of shaming them for not paying up.
Right.
A New Jersey hospital chain, this is all in the last 3 weeks, a New Jersey hospital chain paid a ransomware crew to get back online. Got a nice write-up here from Kevin Beaumont, who says that some of this big game ransomware is being delivered via pre-auth bugs in the Pulse Secure VPN. There seems to be a bit of a rumor that that's how TravelX wound up having a bad time. And a fantastic case study here from Brian Krebs about how ransomware crews are doing like wholesale password theft from organizations before they burn them down. And it's just, you know, the eviction problem is getting really hard. I think we're at the point where we can call this a crisis. What do you think, Alex? I mean, it is a crisis, isn't it?
It is a huge crisis. Now, the reality is the crisis of small to medium businesses, in some cases, large enterprises having really bad IT security. That crisis has actually existed for decades. What ransomware has done is it has brought to the forefront of how bad processes have gone at the vast majority of organizations on the planet. And so I think in this case, you know, the Krebs stuff, especially, I think people should read. I think it's fascinating that the ransomware authors are archiving and backing up the data themselves before they do the encryption, because that does open up a whole new set of monetization opportunities. You know, the automated opportunities are just listing companies and dumping their data automatically. But clearly, for situations in which some of these companies have very sensitive data that can be monetized in other ways that are more human intensive.
LifeLabs, the laboratory, you know, the medical laboratory company in Canada, they paid to get data back for 15 million patients.
Yes. Right. And I'm not sure how else they would have stayed in business. And so I think it is a crisis. And the way that governments have reacted to this as a legal issue to deal with on an independent basis is clearly not working. You know, in some of these stories, it does talk about how there have been some indictments. There's the indictment of the Evil Corp guy in Russia. And so, you know, there might be some ability to establish a little bit of deterrence, but clearly a significant portion of the black hats in the world are now putting all of their efforts behind this area because it's become so profitable. And so we're going to have to start to do some more aggressive things to flip the table on this.
Now, look, the FBI has in recent years really stepped up, right? And they've been making excellent strides in sort of tackling a lot of this stuff. But you sort of get the feeling that maybe a different approach is needed. And this is something that we have been talking about on the show for quite some time now. But the idea of unleashing perhaps some, you know, US federal agencies, setting them loose against these crews. I mean, steal their Bitcoin, dox them, out them, you know, so that other criminal groups will, you know, van them and get their Bitcoin that way. I mean, there needs to be a real cost to this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the use of offensive assets, like the way that Cyber Command disrupts government groups, is reasonable in this case. The benefit here is all you have to do is disrupt the payment pipeline, right? So work to make it difficult for people to make the Bitcoin payments, getting rid of, you know, knocking off the support pages and the other kinds of infrastructure that exists to make sure that people get their money. I think that is worthwhile, because if you can reduce the profitability, it certainly will reduce the number of actors in this space.
I mean, you can chase those Bitcoins through the blockchain pretty easily, right? If you've got that sort of access and you know, if you've got shells everywhere.
Yeah. No, I think, definitely. And also, if the NSA is sitting on half of the hash rate, maybe this is the chance to
That's controversial, man. Did you just say that? You want to bust out the NSA supercomputers to like reverse blockchain commits, like blockchain transactions?
Well, the interesting thing here, too, is I think the other people that should be paying attention here are people from the cryptocurrency space, because
it is a threat to them, isn't it? And they don't realize it.
It is a threat. It is a significant threat. The fact that like a significant amount of the support for Bitcoin's price is the fact that Bitcoin has become the de facto currency of this kind of extortion is going
now,
to...
Now, Alex, it is used for other things, too. I mean, like buying heroin.
Right. You can use it to buy heroin and to pay people to kill folks without them ever actually doing it, right?
There's
lots of ways you can get ripped off with Bitcoin. But I think this is a real kind of policy risk to the cryptocurrency space overall. And so those are the voices that we should actually hear a lot of, is you should have the legitimate crypto companies should really be pushing for more law enforcement work here. They also need to band together to make this harder for, you know, there's been a couple of efforts to try to trace, money through the Bitcoin system. That has been stolen or gone through ill-gotten means, and then making it harder for people to take that out. Because for the most part, people are still not buying stuff with Bitcoin. They're taking it out into a fiat currency. And so there have been some people who have done work in that space. This would be the time to start to disrupt these groups if you want cryptocurrencies to stay legal around the world.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think it's like, how much worse does it need to get before, you know, governments just say, that's it, no more crypto exchanges. We're not going to let you buy the Bitcoin.
Yes, and if they don't let people buy the Bitcoin, this entire space goes away. And also the value of the holdings of a lot of criminals go down. Now, obviously, it also hurts a lot of individual investors, which are going to be a good thing.
Yeah, that's it. And then they have to go back to Western Union and getting arrested by the Secret Service guys hiding behind the pot plants when they come to pick up the cash, right? Like the good old days. What else happened while I was away? Oh, there was someone used Twitter's Android API to like enumerate, to match phone numbers to accounts. I mean, we've seen similar stuff happen before, but essentially what they did is they generated a whole bunch of random phone numbers and then just sort of, you know, enumerated the account IDs. This is a privacy risk, I guess, for some Twitter users who operate anonymously. You know, I mean, if there's a politician or a senior public servant or whatever, and you can throw their phone number at Twitter and all of a sudden, you know, you've got their handle, that's kind of a big deal for them. They've since, blocked this guy's attempts, but I don't know if there's been any substantial improvement to the way they operate that API. What do we know here?
Yeah, so it looks like this was a issue with Twitter's contact uploader and matching. This has been an issue that has been faced by effectively every messenger app or social app, in that one of the key primary keys that is used for people to identify who their social network is phone number. And in every jurisdiction around the world, phone numbers are highly predictable, structured, easily guessed, and low entropy. And so it is... If you are going to design a system for a unique ID that needs to be resolved in a private manner, a phone number is exactly how you would not do it. And so we took advantage of the fact that you can mass upload a bunch of phone numbers for Twitter for contact matching. You know, Twitter was doing detection of whether or not those numbers were sequential. So this guy generated billions of numbers and then uploaded them in random parts. Twitter clearly was missing the kinds of rate limiting necessary to prevent that from being abused. And he was able to resolve 17 million random numbers to real accounts. And so that is a significant problem. It is, again, a problem that has been faced by lots and lots of companies, including Facebook when I was there. And it's a hard one to fix if you want to provide the functionality of people being upload their contact list.
We've got an interesting story here from Catalin Kimpanu, which talks about a Chinese APT crew, APT-20. They've been rolling in through people's JBoss servers and lateral movement, yada, yada, yada. What's interesting here, though, is they seem to be bypassing RSA Secure ID.
Secure ID is a disaster, right? It has been a disaster since Secure ID was hacked by a Chinese group as part of an ingredient attack against Lockheed Martin years and years ago.
Yeah, when they got all the seeds, right?
Yeah, when they got all the seeds. Because the fundamental problem with Secure ID is it uses a symmetric pre-shared key as the seed. It does not use asymmetric cryptography. It does not do any kind of trickiness. And so you end up with these cryptographic seeds sitting all over the place. And originally they're supposed to only be in these hardware tokens, but in reality, they're in the hardware tokens. They're in a CD that gets shipped to you with the hardware tokens for the IT people. They're in the Secure ID server. And in this case, they're also in soft tokens that people use all the time, which a soft token is, almost as bad as a password, right? In that once it is,
well, especially if it's on the same machine, especially if it's on the same machine that you're trying to protect, right? Like that's just insane.
It is not two-factor. We ran into this when I was at Yahoo, and we had an intrusion by a group that was working for the FSB. One of the things they did was they broke into our Secure ID server, stole all the seeds, and then they were able to come back authenticating as random employees. We dropped Secure ID and replaced it all with Duo over a weekend. And that was our solution there. If you're running Secure ID in 2020, you deserve to get hacked. I'm just going to say it. Like this is not how people should do two-factor anymore. You should be using WebAuthn if you want to have hardware tokens. It eliminates all of these issues with Secure ID. But if you're okay with soft tokens or you're okay with push notifications, then I recommend Duo.
We're catching up on a lot of news, obviously, because we've been on break. But so we're not really talking about many bugs. But this one in Citrix, man, in Citrix ADC looks pretty bad. So I thought it was worth a mention.
Yep. This looks like a critical flaw in Citrix's application delivery controller, which is a effectively an SSL VPN you can run on the public internet that allows access to apps supposed to be in a secure way behind it. There's not a lot of details in here other than it's something to be prevented by a web app firewall. So it sounds like some kind of authorization flaw, but this would allow access to the apps behind without authentication that they were estimating 80,000 companies are currently exposing this to the internet. There's a lot of Citrix still out there, right? There's a lot of companies that have to provide some thick client on Windows 2000 that talks to a backend AS400. And the only way to do that to a modern workforce is through Citrix usually. And so there's still a lot of Citrix out there. And almost by definition, any app behind a Citrix gateway is extremely important because it's something that you could not rebuild and replace with a modern technology. Probably a significant, significant issue.
Yeah, I saw Brett Moore do an amazing many, many years ago. I think it was Brett doing a talk at KiwiCon about messing with Citrix ADC, and I think he managed to pop shell through Notepad or something. Like once he got app access, and that's the sort of thing that like I see a headline this that's sort of largely going unnoticed, and you just go, smells good.
Yeah. Well, this is the kind of, this is great because this is the kind of research you get when researchers go off the beaten path and they go and they look at things that are only used by enterprises and are incredibly critical. Like this is the kind of thing you might figure out if you go to your bank and you talk to your teller and you lean over and look at their computer screen. It's quite possible they're running a Citrix thin client with a bunch of Windows apps remoted from a cluster using Citrix onto that thin client. It is a critical piece of technology for a lot of companies.
Yeah. Moving on to some law and order. One of the so-called Turkish crime family has been sentenced in the United Kingdom. No prison time, which is a very United Kingdom sort of approach to these things.
Yes, it's unfortunate that they let this guy off only with this hand slap, although it sounds like he didn't actually hack anything. So this is a guy who blackmailed Apple, saying that he had access to hundreds of millions of iCloud accounts. Now, obviously, there's always been a problem of credential stuffing into iCloud accounts. That's how we've ended up with a bunch of different scandals around people's private photos being stolen and the like.
They seem to have got on top of that, though, like pretty quickly after that.
Right. No. So Apple's has improved their detection a lot. They've, you know, pushed required two-factor. But this guy was just making like ridiculous claims. You know, in one of these tweets in the story, the number of Apple credentials have increased from 519 million to 627 million. We're convinced it will keep growing. Like, clearly he wasn't even making a threat that sounded reasonable, but he was making a threat. And the fact that this guy was arrested in 2017 and now gets to walk totally free is really unfortunate, because I think this is exactly the kind of behavior that we want governments to discourage.
Yeah, you got a 6-month electronic curfew as well. And it's funny because Sammy Kamkar wound up being not allowed to touch computers for a while after the Sammy MySpace worm. And I saw him do a talk where he's like, it's the best thing that ever happened to me. I had to learn how to socialize. And, you know, for anyone who's met Sammy, he's actually a really sort of charming, cruising humorous dude. So he's like, yeah, no, I was a total nerd before that. they kicked me off computers and I had to learn, which is right. Very funny. So maybe it'll be great for this guy.
Maybe. Yeah, you know, maybe that's what we should explicitly, court should create systems to kick these guys off computers and make them interact with normal people.
Make them pick up hobbies, you know, join clubs, exactly. That sort of thing. Meanwhile, a member of the Dark Overlord crew, these guys were doing a lot of, you know, extortion-y sort of stuff with stolen data. British guy extradited to the US. That's not a good sign for you, Nathan Francis Wyatt, 39.
Nope. This is a common story where the United States is by far, it seems to be the most aggressive democracy, at least, in prosecuting hacking crimes against its own companies. This guy has a long, long list of breaches that he has been attached to, or at least his group has been attached to, of some really random groups, but also stealing things like patient records from a healthcare provider, extorting cancer services of East Central Indiana. So that's not going to play very well with the U.S. No. Attorney's Office in Indiana, attacking the cancer services. So
other victims include a puppy hospital, and, you know, like it's not the best, yeah. Is it?
So this guy was really not setting himself up for success, I think, in his appeal against being extradited. He is going to have a book thrown at him that is going to be at least a decade in jail, is my expectation.
Ouch. Yeah, that's pretty hectic. What else we got here? Oh, now this whole thing has settled down now. It's sort of been and gone. There was a real crazy thing that happened in Russia where the founder of Nginx, of course, got sold to F5 for like $500 million. But the authorities raided the Nginx, like Russian offices, on a criminal copyright complaint. The founder's former employer was like, he developed this on company time, where, you know, that is very hotly disputed. Turned into a massive controversy. There was a whole bunch of pushback, and the company Rambler has dropped the Nginx criminal case. But wow, what a wild ride.
Yeah, it sounds like a wild ride. You know, these open source sales are always really sketchy to me, because it does really call into question, what are you buying when you're buying an open source product? It looks like in this case, the Rambler people were able to weaponize parts of the Russian legal system to support an extortion attempt. There doesn't seem to be a lot of support for their position in the facts. But obviously, if you can make people's life hell and you're now playing around with $670 million, there's a lot of opportunity to create a reason for people to pay you off. It's a very complicated story, so I don't want to come down too hard on it, but I am glad that it seems to have ended in a way that nobody's sitting in jail for, perhaps a license dispute over an open source web server.
Yeah. Another big story while I was on leave was this whole controversy around Ring cameras, because it turns out, you know, there's like zillions of creds for Ring security cameras floating around various forums, and a whole bunch of people just love logging into people's Ring cameras and like scaring children and stuff like that. And of course, I think what happened here is Amazon made it much, much worse when they came out and said, well, the users didn't configure 2FA. What do you expect? And it's like, hang on, you know, you shouldn't offer a service like this without 2FA. And I was very happy to see the pushback really materialize along those lines.
Yeah, so I'm of mixed feelings here. So first off, there's kind of a coordinated push in the American tech media against Rin right now on privacy issues that are orthogonal to what we're talking about here. Like, people don't like the idea of, you know, these kinds of cameras have existed for a long time. What Rin allows people to do is to really easily upload videos to these miniature social networks that are tied to people's physical locations, which clearly can be used for good things. It can also be used to, like, racially profile and such. And so there's, like, kind of a mini controversy that's been drummed up, I think, by a number of journalists of Rin is bad because of they're, you know, allowing people to upload this stuff. I know a number of Ring customers who love the product, right? Like, my parents are getting older, so I set them up with some Ring stuff. They love the idea that they can see who's at the doorbell when it gets Ringed, run. You know, there is goods and bads with these products. And so I think that has driven some of this coverage, because I do agree there are problems that if you're going to build a product that is cloud attached, that is meant for consumers, for normal people
and
to use,
and is absolutely privacy critical.
Right, and is privacy critical, then the basic things you have to do is you have to have really good risk-based authentication. So you need to have really aggressive analytics about somebody's login history. Amazon should normally be in a great place to do that, because so many people have Amazon accounts and spend all day on their Amazon, so they should have a huge amount of data to feed into risk-based analytics. You also need to probably require two-factor, right? And since you're shipping physical devices, there's all kinds of cute things I think you could do to help facilitate that with, like, a card that's shipped with it, you know, a QR code backup, all that kind of stuff. That is easier for a physical company like Rain than, say, a Google or Twitter. So there are some legitimate problems, but I also think there's been a little bit of overblowing of this because Rain is controversial for other purposes. I really don't like, actually, the headline in the Motherboard article, "We tested Rain security, it's awful," because what a lot of people are implying is that the devices themselves are being broken into, not that people are reusing passwords everywhere and that Ring has failed to get people to use good practices.
I'm going to push back on you a little bit there, because we understand, like, anyone operating a consumer service like this should understand that people do reuse passwords. Like, that is just a fact of life, right? So if you can't offer a compensating control, you shouldn't offer the service, like, straight up.
No, and I think they should, but I think there has been a kind of an effort to frame up the Ring devices themselves with security issues in a way that I think is inaccurate. But I do think there is a failure here. And of all the companies, again, Ring is part of Amazon. Amazon has much better security around their normal Amazon account. So it is kind of shocking that you end up with a situation in one of their subsidiaries.
Yeah, and that's the part that I think we got to focus on here. I do agree with you. I don't think Motherboard so much is guilty of this, but some of the other coverage around this is like, Ring cameras hacked. And yeah, some of that mainstream coverage was absolutely terrible. But at the end of the day, if it gives them the kick in the pants they need, I think that might be okay. What do we got here? This story, God, this is just crazy, right? Some time ago, a cryptocurrency exchange founder apparently died quite young, leaving behind no passwords or recovery keys or anything like that. So a whole bunch of money just went boom. And now it looks like a bunch of his investors want his body exhumed so they can make sure he's dead. This is crazy.
This is crazy. I mean, so this gentleman, Gary Cotton, is the founder of a cryptocurrency exchange called Quadriga CX. So one, if you're giving something called that tens of millions of your dollars in cryptocurrency, then that's probably on you. She is claiming that he died in India at the age of 30 of Crohn's disease, which is
That's his widow. Yeah.
Yeah. His widow is making this claim. And, you know, Crohn's disease is a very kind of terrible problem that people have with their digestive systems. And it's very embarrassing and painful. But it is extremely, extremely not, you know, rare to be fatal. So it's just a
It can be.
And so, like, but it's just, you know, like, he's traveling, he's in India, he dies of complications of Crohn's disease, and then that there's no backup, that there's no accounting, that there's really, you know, if what everything she's saying is true, then this company and everybody involved with it should probably be prosecuted for some kind of fraud, because this is just incredibly dumb planning for what should be a financial services company. But it also very well could be a scam. And so I don't think it's crazy for these guys to want to look into whether or not this guy's actually buried where they're saying he's buried. There's a long history of small to medium size cryptocurrency exchanges all of a sudden, quote unquote, getting hacked, going out of business. And then all of a sudden the founders are on an island somewhere. And so the odds that this guy is still alive somewhere, probably still in India, living it up, are not zero for sure.
They're not zero, but it just seems pretty radical. But yeah, it just reminds me, what is it? Lionel Hutz no longer exists. My name is Manuel Sanchez. You know, could right. be one of them.
I probably can't recommend Manuel Sanchez as your name to hide out in the beaches of Goa, but who knows?
Yeah, probably not. A little bit conspicuous. Oh, now this one I love. This is one of my favorite types of scams. There was a guy who did this in Australia. He got caught as well, but he was sending invoices to Australian mining companies for full page ads in fictitious magazines, and they were just paying them, right? Like, he did this for years before eventually getting caught. A Lithuanian scammer has just got 5 years for defrauding Google and Facebook of, and here's this, it wasn't a few hundred thousand bucks, $120 million, but $120 million by firing off some emails. This is inspired. I'm almost sorry the guy got caught.
So this guy is kind of the dog that caught the car. So I was at Facebook when this happened. I was actually, when this was happening, I was there. And so I know a lot about it. I was actually in a FBI skiff at Quantico for an event that they were holding for corporate CISOs. And I get back to my dorm room in Quantico and I turn on my phone, which obviously I couldn't take into the skiff. And it basically vibrates off the table for all of the phone calls and voicemails of Alex, where the hell are you? And so I fly back in an emergency and we do a big investigation because $100 million had gone missing. So effectively what this guy did was very low tech and very effective and a kind of fraud that happens all the time, which is he contacted Facebook accounts payable. And he did so using a domain that was a lookalike domain for Quanta Computer of Taiwan. And he created a PDF with a realistic looking, he got the signature of the CEO off some public document. He got their logo and everything. And he told the accounts payable people, our bank account has changed. And he changed the bank from some bank in Taipei to the Bank of Nicosia in Cyprus. And Facebook's account payable, which is actually outsourced to a company that had outsourced it to Manila, somebody in Manila saw this, didn't double check it, and changed. And so, but here's how he's the dog that caught the car, right? So the people who do this all the time are usually stealing a couple $100,000, maybe $1 million, right? And so if you steal $500,000 via this kind of fraud from a big public company, that company will probably call the FBI, and the FBI will take notes, right?
Don't tell me they were paying the legitimate invoices into this other account.
Yeah, so that's what happened. Oh, so Quanta Computer is one of the largest vendors to all of Facebook. And so the first payment that Quanta was supposed to get, they make all of Facebook servers. The first payment was $99 million. And so it turns out for $99 million, if that money does not show up in the vendor's account on the exact moment it's supposed to, they will call you and they will say, hey, excuse us,
Facebook.
Where's
that money?
we're pretty sure that $99 million is sure to show up in Bank of Taipei.
Like just two transactions, because I misread it initially, because obviously there's been a lot to go through, so I didn't really dive into this one. But holy God, man.
The Google one's obviously separate, but the one from Facebook was like just one or two payments that happened at the same time. And so I'm expecting, this is like the scene from Office Space where they go to the ATM and they have hundreds of thousands of dollars instead of pennies, that this guy like opened up his bank account at Bank of Cyprus and then saw there's $100 million in there. What he should have done at that moment was taken
My name is Manuel Sanchez.
I'm Manuel Sanchez. Faked his death and taken every piece of electronics that he owns and throw it into the ocean. What he actually tried to do is he tried to get the money out. And so for $100 million, the Southern District of New York FBI will take your phone call. Deutsche Bank, which was the Relane Bank, took our phone call. The Bank of Cyprus will get their CEO on the phone with you because now they're afraid of their SWIFT transfer capability being taken over. And so, if you're going to steal money, steal a couple hundred grand that people aren't going to care about. If you steal $100 million, it is really easy to get everybody involved to actually get caught.
So I'm guessing everyone got their money back.
Everybody got their money back, is my understanding, yeah.
Yeah, ouch, man. That's a nice little story there, and I'm glad you were around at the time and you could give us some backstory on that.
It was just a funny day because it's like the one day I'm in a skiff and not reachable. So like from then on, I never turn my phone off because I know if I was out of reach for 6 hours, that $100 million was going to get stolen.
That's a few dollars. We got another one from Catalan here at ZDNet, talking about how webcache deception attacks still impact websites with substantial user populations. A bit of an interesting read there, just about how, yeah, I mean, just, you know, some pretty simple little webcaching attacks are still bearing fruit. I mean, they shouldn't. This shouldn't work still, right?
This shouldn't work. I'm actually kind of surprised that the frameworks people use to build these apps are still vulnerable. It's really unfortunate that this is working. The 2017 example was PayPal, which is obviously a big deal. Now it seems like it's smaller apps for the most part.
Essentially, you just get a user to hit a, you know, /my account/home/fictitious-file-name.whatever. And then if they hit that, you know, that page gets populated with some of their information, and then you can retrieve it from the CDN via hitting the same URL, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, effectively, I think what's happened is a number of production systems now run multiple levels of CDN and caching, and it becomes very complicated of what is being cached where and what is being marked as being ephemeral or not. And so that does get confusing. This is the kind of thing, though, that you should be able to scan for. So it is a little shocking that it hasn't been fixed more widespread.
iOS, iPhones, and iPads now have WebAuthn, which is pretty cool. And I kind of noticed this. I figured it was WebAuthn, or maybe like a Apple, like almost WebAuthn, when I bought a new phone recently and I was going through the setup and there was some step where it was like Safari Face ID'd me. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's new.
Yeah, this is great. So, you know, WebAuthn is the successor to FIDO, which is that standard that powered all those little USB keys. Now we have a much broader set of things that can do WebAuthn. So, yes, the devices themselves can be an authenticator. Windows computers will do authentication if they have the right TPMs now. There are NFC and Bluetooth physical keys. I'm carrying around one of those YubiKeys that has Lightning on one side and USB-C on the other. And so the fact that it is supported by default is fantastic. This is great because Apple was the last holdout and was really holding back WebAuthn as a standard that you could rely upon. Google has probably been the company that has pushed it the hardest. And so now that Apple's on board, I think we can see some real acceleration of this becoming a legitimate option for especially high-risk users to be using across all of their devices.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that's going to be everywhere pretty quick, right? Like people don't quite realize how much, you know, now that it's integrated into browsers, like people are just going to use it.
Right. I mean, we were just talking about with Ring and passwords, like the entire username and password paradigm is a disaster. And so the fact that now Apple is supporting the best option for using these pocket supercomputers with secure hardware enclaves and on-device biometrics and the like to do remote authentication, I think that's a really good step.
Yeah. And, you know, also having a YubiKey as well that you can use across multiple devices. I mean, just options, right? And it's not even necessarily just about securing an account. It's also when you start using some of these devices, you get more account recovery options, right? And that's quite important because of takeovers and yada, yada, yada. Yep. Can tell I've been watching Seinfeld lately. Moving on. And Mozilla is forcing all add-on developers to use 2FA to prevent supply chain attacks. I don't think we really need to talk about that one, but that's interesting. NPM, meanwhile, only 9.27% of all NPM developers use 2FA, but there was a bad bug too. You know, you take that stat and combine it with this bug, and it's like, yeah, the supply chain's not looking so hot. There was like an ultra old school like overwrite bug for NPM packages. They've patched it. This was late last year that it popped up. It was like a couple of days after I finished up for the year last year. But those sort of bugs combined with that sort of carelessness, wow.
Yeah, this is, you know, NPM is a really big risk. It's used everywhere. It's used server-side for Node, but also a lot of client-side apps people are using are built on the Electron framework, and NPM is a critical part of the build cycle for most Electron apps. And so these kinds of vulnerabilities are not just going to hit the server side that we've traditionally seen, but you could very well see something like an NPM bug end up with malware ending up in a really widely used Electron app done on lots and lots of desktops.
Yeah, essentially this client bug allows you to write to places where you shouldn't be able to write. You know, it's the same sort of thing that, it's like old school archiver bug sort of thing, you know, it just shouldn't be there. Interesting.
Path traversal, right? It's like something that you teach, you know, in a freshman security seminar of very, very old school Unix bugs.
Yeah, and just to wrap it up, what have we got here? A nice stat from another one from Catalan. He's been pumping them out as usual. half of the websites using WebAssembly use it for malicious purposes. Can't say I'm terribly surprised by that. What have we got here? Forbes is reporting, this is interesting actually, that the United States is launching a fresh assault on Apple's warrant-proof encryption. Looks like we might be in for a rerun of the San Bernardino case.
Yes, it does. So for folks who don't know, we had a kind of terrible shooting at the Naval Air Station in Pensacola, Florida, by a aviation student who turned out to be part of a Saudi group that was in the United States. He had two iPhones, and the FBI has started down the path of building, it sounds like, the legal case to try to force Apple to help them unlock it. So they have made a official request to Apple, which I am sure they know is going to be denied. They have also crossed their I's and dotted their T's in that they have gone a search warrant to allow them to use third-party hacking tools such as Graykey. It looks like those searches have failed. And so this combined with the fact that the U.S. attorney for Texas was making a call that the government needs to enact legislation is that we might be seeing another coordinated attempt to kind of build a case for Apple to build a backdoor that they can push into this iPhone because no other options exist.
And look, we're going to wrap it up now, but I'm just going to mention two stories that we are going to put into, like, you know, just the last two in the show notes, which make for good reading. There's a story from Krebs called The Great $50 Million African IP Address Heist. That's, you know, there's corruption, intrigue. It's a fun read. And there's a fantastic piece from Jenna McLaughlin and Zach Dorfman at Yahoo News. It's really funny when those two pop up with bylines on Yahoo News because it's like pretty much the only thing I ever read on Yahoo News, but they keep pumping out the good stuff. And it's just really about how human intelligence collection has changed in the digital age for the United States. And it's just a very good read. And I recommend people check it out. But Alex, that is actually it for the news. The first news segment for season 14 of Risky Business. Thanks so much for joining us. And we'll be chatting to you again throughout the year, I'm sure.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Patrick. And I want to say I'm glad you and your family are safe. And my hearts go out to everybody else in Australia who's suffering right now. But thank you very much for having me. I'm looking forward to doing this again.
That was Alex Stamos there with a chat about all the security news that's fit to publish. Big thanks to him for that. Now, look, I'm going to switch back to talking about the fires for just a moment. You know, as people know, homes have been lost. People have been killed. It's estimated that 1 billion animals have been killed, and the destruction is just on an unprecedented scale. You know, a lot of my friends and some listeners would know that I like to go camping and do a bit of travel here in Australia, and pretty much every place I like to go to has been burned out. And, you know, I'm not talking within a two-hour radius here. This is over a stretch of the country that spans something like, 1,700 kilometres or like 1,100 miles. It's just insane. We're seeing the Gondwana forests catch on fire. I mean, these are wet rainforests that have never burned before. So while we're safe here, we are watching our country, parts of our country be just destroyed by fire. And Australia will not recover in my lifetime. Some ecosystems will be permanently altered. And this brings me to the subject of climate change. I mean, climate change has undoubtedly played a part in this destruction. Despite attempts by various people to pin the blame elsewhere, any reading of the long-term climate data will show you that the main contributor to this disaster is, in fact, climate change. Now, yesterday, Risky Business Media donated $3,000 to the Red Cross Appeal and maybe more importantly, $2,000 to the Australian Climate Council. And these are the people who will pressure our pro-coal government into rethinking its standard practice of fallating coal companies as a national priority. After I made those donations, I told my followers on Twitter that anyone who gives a donation of $1,000 Australian dollars or more will get a shout out on the podcast. So here goes. First up, Alex Stamos actually chipped in. Thanks, Alex. Mark Dowd had already donated $10,000 to the Rural Fire Service and not really told anyone, so I'm dobbing him in here. Thanks, Mark. InfoSec recruiter Ricky Burke has chipped in a grand. Ian Green of Google, another grand, which I believe is being matched by Google. Mr. or Ms. UXP on Twitter has kindly donated some money. Ryan Callumber from Proofpoint also donated. He's a good egg. I've gotten to know Ryan a bit over the last couple of years. Daniel Gordon, you are also a champion, Daniel. Thanks for your donation. Our friends at Thug Crowd have also donated to the crisis. Andre Protas, what a legend you are. He has also donated some cash. We've raised a few thousand bucks. That's great. And it looks like the government since has set up a fund and charitable donations have been just off the scale. So I sort of feel like at this point, you know, if you want to help, the best way to help, there's so many good charities doing good work. There's the World Wildlife Fund, there's WIRES, which is an animal, you know, charity here in Australia. Or you can, like me, donate to the Australian Climate Council. And they are a charity here in Australia, which means Australian donations are treated as a tax deduction. And they are the group behind the Emergency Leaders for Climate Change Action Initiative. They are the former fire chiefs who wrote to the government in April last year predicting this crisis. They were ignored by our Prime Minister because evidently he had more important things to do, like planning his trip to Hawaii. But anyway, long story short, I'm fine. My family is fine. My country is not. And hopefully the fires will be out soon. Thanks again to everyone for their messages of concern. And of course, all of those who donated, I appreciate both of those things. And yeah, if you want a shout out on Risky Biz, send some money to a bushfire-related charity and you'll get all the shouts. Email your receipts to editorial@risky.biz. Okay, onwards into this week's sponsor interview now with a fine Australian gent, Casey Ellis, the founder and CTO of Bug Crowd. He joined me for this interview in December last year, in which we discussed the US government's decision to make all US government departments start accepting bug reports for at least one online asset immediately and start accepting bug reports for all online assets within 2 years. Now, this is obviously going to be great for Bug Crowd and its competitors, because it's unlikely most government departments will have the time or expertise needed to handle the triage here. But in addition to that, Casey says this policy will have an even broader effect than just being good for business. It makes taking bug submissions from the public a normal thing to do. It really legitimizes the practice. And not surprisingly, he thinks that's great. Here's what Casey had to say.
With this one, you know, my level of excitement is similar to how I felt when Hacked the Pentagon went live, because that was something that obviously was meaningful for Department of Defense and other government agencies, but was meaningful, I think, for everyone. You know, they look at this concept, they look at, you know, ethical hackers, researchers, whatever you want to call them, that are out there and able to give input. And, you know, we're at a point now, I think, in the market where everyone is intrigued by that idea, if they're, you know, if it's part of their job, if they've heard about it.
Hack the Pentagon was a closed program, wasn't it? It wasn't just open slather.
But it made a bunch of noise, I think.
I'm with you. I'm just for clarity's sake, it was not quite like mandating, you know, open vulnerability reporting lines across government, which is what this is.
Initially, and then they opened out their VDP program, which was, you know, the thing that's kind of cemented and showed everyone what it looks like when you're doing it for real.
Oh, okay. So they're actually taking reports from the public now, are they?
Oh, yeah. And, oh, okay. And that was... because you were right there from a sequencing standpoint. They did the private stuff and then rolled out the public.
Yeah.
But I think the announcement of the whole thing was really the thing that we saw cause a pretty major shift in the way people thought about hackers, for starters, but then also what we're doing in terms of trying to connect, you know, people with program owners.
It kind of blows a hole in that whole argument that you hear, you know, people who are a little bit self-important saying, well, we can't encourage, you know, the unwashed internet masses to be hacking away at our web apps. And I guess, the US military doing that kind of undercuts the argument there.
You could argue, I think, fairly convincingly that, like, the US military is like the apex predator or the apex defender, probably both, around right now. And if they're reaching out to the hacker community for help, then it means that probably everyone else should think about that as well.
Yeah. I feel like this DHS one's different though, because it's all of government, right? And we associate security concepts with military. I mean, they're pretty closely linked. So, you know, you might think, wow, okay, armed forces doing something forward leaning in that space, you know, not really a huge surprise. But when you look at DHS saying, you know, the Department of Agriculture needs to have a security at mailbox and functioning triage, that's a whole different level of trying to say this is something organizations should do, which is to accept reports and have scope and policies.
Absolutely. And that taps back on part of what you were saying before, just around the scale of availability to deal with the issue. Like, when you think about the US government in aggregate, it's a massive attack surface. Like, there's so much stuff, and it goes back so many years that, you know, the whole idea of using automation or using people that are being paid by the hour to cover all of it is just not going to work. Like, we're at a point where, you know, the rubber band's stretched a little too thin on that one. So I think that's a logical response to it. And, you know, for the folks that step up beyond that and do things that are proactive and so on, that's when they're starting to drive behavior, and that's good too. I think the other side of it is really this kind of broader idea of consumer confidence. And in this case, the consumer is like the American public and arguably the rest of the world looking on, right? That, okay, you guys have gone out and established Neighborhood Watch for your internet stuff. Like, we can therefore be more confident in the fact that you're taking that stuff seriously. And obviously that depends on how they deal with the issues and all of that. But I think the fact that it's easy to understand as a concept, but also the public nature of it, I think actually that goes a long way for transparency to instill trust.
Look, I think there are going to be some problems here. I think one of them is that there's going to be a bunch of organizations like government departments and stuff that do actually set up the reporting lines and have a policy, but they're going to do a terrible job of triage, and they're going to be too stingy to actually reach out to companies like you. You know, there's a few, right? And they're going to eventually get spanked for it, right? And there's going to be a bit of a learning curve there for everybody involved. When I look at what DHS has published so far, it looks like, yeah, they're going to allow departments to do it themselves or contract it out to companies like Bugcrowd. Yeah. Have you had discussions with DHS on this stuff that you can talk about?
Yeah, totally. I mean, part of the kind of the draft language for the directive has been published by CISA, and it's like available for open comment. You know, we've spoken to them. We've spoken to others.
Is the idea that there's going to be like approved suppliers of triage services? Is that kind of the idea?
I don't think there's going to be a dependency on that. I think the thing that they're more concerned about right now is that the process, you know, as you said, like, there are tripping hazards in going from not doing this to having it fully baked, right? And the priority of the DHS and the folk that we've worked with so far has been helping people navigate towards that end state whilst, you know, avoiding
as much crap. It's so weird because what you're telling me is... It's so weird because what you're telling me is they're focused on the right stuff, right? Which I'm still not quite used to, but
so far so good. Like, CISA as an agency has been, you know, they've done some incredible work. Like, you know, the stuff that they did with release of the audit tool for election security just recently, like, just in general, I think they've really stepped up into figuring out, like, what solutions do we actually need? Like, there's an optical component to security for the population that they obviously need to fulfill.
Yeah.
But then, like, what's right? What's actually going to work?
Well, there was just things like the binding directive earlier this year in light of all of the domain name hijackings that were happening and man-in-the-middle weirdness, you know, issuing a binding directive saying you need to put 2FA on your domain reg now. Seems like a really sort of appropriate use of that sort of authority. Now, look, speaking of elections, this is something that you're paying attention to. Obviously, 2020 in the United States, where you live, it's an election year. And, you know, you're kind of keen to get involved. But tell me what that looks like. Like, how can a company like Bugcrowd wind up sort of getting involved in helping to mitigate some of the security challenges faced by the elections in 2020?
Yeah, for sure. Like, where I live, but don't and actually cannot vote currently.
Yes, so,
like,
that's right.
that adds a kind of an angle to the whole thing. You know, I think honestly, what Western democracy just in general is facing right now is a you know, acceleration of change in technology and communications, especially, that has kind of outpaced the way that we've done this type of thing for the past 100 or more years. And it's not just a US issue. Like, the US is, you know, the beacon on the hill, or however you want to kind of think about it or frame it, for democracy globally. And is therefore, I think, a really important point of you know, call it the water cooler effect to actually get this right. With the issue itself, it's a whole bunch of different stuff that's coming into play. Like, there's all of the talk that's gone on around voting machines. I think that's been... it's been good that's been highlighted.
I think though that there has been a bit of an unhealthy obsession almost with voting machine security when the vulnerabilities clearly lie elsewhere, right? Which is why we don't tend to cover voting machine security stories on the show.
Yeah, Yeah, so you're absolutely, that's literally preempted what I was just about to say. I think the main reason for that is that, you know, the average voter does like touch and interact with that system physically.
Yeah, no, it makes sense, yeah.
Voting. So if you're a journalist, it's easier to write about.
Yeah.
But you're right. Like there's, you know, e-poll books, there's like voter registration systems. There's all of these different things that as a foreign actor or even now a domestic actor with a foreign playbook, you could jump into and mess about with in the 2020 election. I guess where BugCrowd fits into this is that I genuinely believe, particularly vulnerability disclosure as a, you know, as a transparency vehicle, but also as a vehicle for security feedback into the organizations that are running these systems is a logical fit. And I don't think it's the silver bullet, but I do think it can go a long way to finding what needs to be fixed so it can be fixed, but then also making sure that we're restoring confidence in the voting population.
So you're talking about things like county systems that might be responsible for maintaining various election-related bits and pieces.
Yeah, it's been a remarkable rabbit hole to go down, to be frank. Like
it's amazing, isn't it? Like as Australians, and we should point this out, is we've got the Australian Electoral Commission here in Australia, which does the whole thing, right? They maintain the voter rolls for state and federal elections and even council elections. They maintain those rolls from a single organisation across the whole country, which, you know, admittedly is easier when your whole country has a population of 24 million people, different history, et cetera, et cetera. But when you start looking at the hodgepodge of how Babby is made when it comes to US elections, it's incredible, isn't it?
Nice meme use there. I think that was spot on. and yeah, like that's literally how the conversation went. Like when I first started talking to some of the folk that are involved in this, that was one of the first questions I asked. Like, why can't blah, blah, department or organization just issue a mandate and let's get all of this fixed from the top down?
Yeah, it doesn't work like that.
And got kind of laughed out of the room as the token gringo at that point because I didn't understand the concept of states' rights as it related back to this particular issue, right? And there are 3,000 counties, 3,007, I think, that have, you know, their own control over each one of these different pieces of voting infrastructure, and they all have to tie back together to perform a federal election.
So given that it is this hodgepodge, though, it's unlikely that DHS will be able to do the same thing that they're doing with, you know, federal government departments and mandating sort of bug reporting and whatever. So, you know, how do you then come in as a, you know, as a third party who can offer some value there and sort of convince those organizations that this is something that they should be doing?
Yeah, the main thing there, that's a great question. The main thing there is working with, you know, it's basically firstly identifying who all's involved in this, because there's a lot of different like actors in the mix at this point, prioritizing and then going off and talking to them. So, you know, there's stuff that we're doing with, for example, the EI-ISAC around voting machine security. Yes, that's not the whole thing as we just discussed, but it is highly visible. It is, you know, a point of potential threat, and it is worth talking about with them. But then, you know, with the states, like the different counties, even in terms of their different kind of, you know, web-based election systems that they're hosting that roll back up into the overall thing, it's really a matter of kind of, you know, making our way down the priority list to make sure that as many folk as possible are, you know, informed of what's available to them when it comes to...
I mean, so this is an initiative of yours to try to get out there and, you know, get those services sort of adopted and accepted among that constituency, right?
Yeah.
But what I'm getting at is there's not going to be a top-down approach where they're going to be sort of funneled towards you. You're going to be having to do this yourself.
No, that's right. Yeah, that's right. And you know, the evidence of that, some of the stuff the DHS has done around this, like they pumped a couple hundred million dollars out into, you know, updating voting infrastructure a few years back. A lot of that was put into replacing the DREs that are in use, so the machines where there's a direct entry into the election system and not a paper ballot as a backup, for example, which, you know, okay, fine. If you built that stuff, you know, 15 years ago, you might have a problem. So they wanted to get rid of that, for example. So there are, you know, there are different kind of case histories of things where there have been initiatives run down the hill from organizations that have, you know, enabled that. But as you point out, like one of the issues here is that there are states' rights where, you know, central kind of ownership of some sort of solution actually would impinge then on the state's rights to conduct an election in the way it sees fit, which is unconstitutional in the US.
Yeah.
So it's kind of tricky.
It feels though that you're wanting to take this on because, you know, you want to help.
Yeah, I mean, I think I kind of like democracy. I think it's the least bad solution that we've got right now. And, you know, I think there is a logical solution fit between what the crowd does and the fact that we're engaging every voter in a given country to give their input to elect the leader. So, like, there's some just agreeable symmetry in the whole thing.
Yeah, that, no, I get where you're coming from.
Yeah.
I get it, so, I get it. No, it's just nice. It's nice to see you all fired up about, you know, an issue that honestly it's not exactly going to be your path to the pot of gold. You know, this seems much more motivated by, you know, a personal desire to actually make a dent.
Yeah, no, for sure. I appreciate that. And, you know, we're seeing that same kind of engagement and feedback from the researchers and even from, you know, the different organizations that are trying to help out with this stuff, like the various ISACs, the people that are joined to those organizations and so on. And, you know, there is obviously the ability for us to be a part of providing solutions to these problems. So it's not like 110% altruistic, but I do think you're right. Like the main driver is like, yeah, I think we can actually put a dent in this problem. Like, let's try.
And we're going to be wishing you all the best with that particular mission, Casey. Thank you very much for joining us on the show. The first show for 2020. It's wonderful to have you back. And we'll be speaking to you again a few times throughout the year. Cheers.
Thanks, Pat.
That was Casey Ellis of Bug Crowd there. Big thanks to him for that. And huge thanks to Bug Crowd for being such a great sponsor over the years. Do track down Bug Crowd for all your bug bounty and crowdsourced security testing needs. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.